Adam, I had a little journey this week.
A literal or a figurative?
It was figurative. It was remote and figurative. I went around the houses trying to find something out.
Figurative houses?
Yeah, they were figurative.
Yeah, okay, I'll just say yes because it's late and I've already pushed us back 2 days. So, right. Yes, Joe.
It's 2 days late.
I'm 2 days late due to having a difficult home life.
Oh.
My wife left me is all. And
right. For good this time or?
Is that what you took me to mean?
That's what I thought you meant.
No, she left me for the weekend and
right.
I was left with the children, and so then our Sunday night record was aborted.
Right.
Found it a tough day, and then in the evening wasn't available as a result, and just wanted to say sorry. Felt like a failure as a father and as a failure as a podcast host. So,
well, listen, I don't know about your dealings as a father, but you're definitely not a failure as a podcast host. I can say that for sure. I'm not your child, so I don't know about that situation.
Don't put an arm. I don't want an arm around my shoulder. I don't want you to try and perk me up with.
No, I'm not. No, I was doing the opposite.
Good.
I was going to say that most adults I know are blaming a lot of stuff on their parents. So I think it's safe to say that whether or not you are a failure as a father, there are definitely going to be times in your children's lives where they think that you are, and they maybe even accuse you of being one.
Yeah, you see, I think I can handle that.
Right.
That's a conversation that someone's having with you. At the minute, it's purely, no, I haven't got, I'm not answering the phone because, hello.
Hi, Dad.
Hi, how's it going?
Is that you, Dad?
Well, yeah, obviously you could, why, you know, you put, can you still not work a phone, son?
Oh, it's me, your son.
Yeah, because you're on
I didn't recognise your voice because I haven't actually spoken to you for some years.
Right, okay.
Do you recognise mine? You obviously do because you...
Well, it comes up as son. It says son when you call. Oh. Loved son.
I just wanted to call to talk.
Yeah, what about?
Well, I've been doing some reflecting as an adult.
Yeah.
And, I've been going to therapy.
Yeah, that's a waste of time, son. I don't know why you're doing that.
I wish you wouldn't say that, Dad.
Sorry. I tried it and it didn't work, but okay. No, well done. I'm really proud of you, talking about your feelings. Well done.
Well, there's some stuff I wanted to talk to you about that's come out of therapy.
Hmm.
And I wondered if you'd listen.
Okay. I mean, I'm recording a podcast with my old friend Joe in about 10 minutes.
Still doing that?
Yeah, I know. He still really needs it. We don't even put them out anymore. But like, his whole personality is built around us recording and just listening to us back our conversations. Even though the feed is dead and we can't afford to do it. But like, I still.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I log on and he. Yeah, he's lost it.
That sounds hard. I'm surprised to hear that though, because I see him everywhere. He seems to be doing really well.
I thought
actually he wouldn't, you know, because he seems to be a really successful person. And if anything, I thought it maybe would be you that would need it, Dad.
Yeah, no, but you're not on the end of the line when he's calling in the middle of the night crying, saying like why he's sold out, nothing he does.
Yeah, success
matters.
Is hard. I've heard that.
Yeah, but he doesn't even think it's success because it's all just like ash in his mouth.
Right.
And he thinks the one good thing that he ever did was the podcast that we record, but you know, no one listens. So I humour him.
Well, I was going to say it makes sense that your wife hasn't left you for good because she didn't mention it when I spoke to her earlier this week.
Oh yeah, that's it. I told her she should message you because she was banging on about what a lovely voice you had.
Oh, I messaged her, Adam.
Oh, okay, great.
Unprompted, because you said something on an episode a couple of weeks ago that I just didn't believe, you know, and I thought, I want to fact check this guy. And to cut a long story short, you're fine. Your facts checked out. I was concerned last week when you said that you attended a school that didn't have any tennis rackets and also that you started in year eight. Right. Yes, disappointingly, I asked your wife if I could contact your sister. I got her phone number from your wife and I contacted your sister. to fact check.
Yeah, I mean, she went to the high school, which is the all girls, and I went to the all boys grammar school. So, yeah.
Yeah. I know the whole story now. But she asked your brother, and then she told me that, yeah, you didn't have any tennis rackets, and you did start in year eight. So it was a bit disappointing, really. You know, I thought it was worth a try, and this could have been so glorious. And I will say, I hope this shows the listeners the length that we're willing to go to on this podcast for editorial rigor and for fact checking. So, you know, just make sure you don't try and slide anything that isn't true past me, because I will contact members of your family and I will find out.
I tell you where I did have tennis courts and tennis rackets.
Where?
Boarding school.
Oh, yeah, you went to boarding school.
for two years in between primary school and secondary school, where I was sent to kind of get us away from the family turmoil.
Right.
And
into some other turmoil.
Well, I was thinking, yeah, lots of turmoil. I was thinking about it because the film we're doing today is The Abyss, and I saw The Abyss on a movie night at boarding school.
Really?
That's why it brought back a lot of memories of that. And I kind of,
wow.
there's a deep shame within me about the fact that I got sent to boarding school for 2 years, because it seems like a well-off, rich thing that kids go.
Because it's expensive to pay for the board.
Right, very expensive. And I say very, very expensive. I don't know how
very
much.
Expensive.
Very, not just expensive, very expensive. I don't know how expensive it was. My father had come into some money as a result of a company he'd worked at, I'm led to believe.
Uh-huh.
And then then thinking about it made me deeply unsettled, because I was just thinking, oh yeah, I was so lucky to get sent to this amazing school, so lucky to be sent away from my family during a very difficult time, so lucky to have no emotional support network.
Yeah.
Oh, so lucky.
I don't think so.
It's so horrible. It's so difficult to feel. It's not only sort of shameful, because when I then went, even at the grammar school, you were taught as a boy to be ashamed of any kind of, I guess then if you were well off, it was embarrassing. You know, you wanted to talk like a Cockney and have authentic working class roots. Otherwise,
yeah,
you were a posh Walter knob from the Beano. So anything like that would have marked you out, and you didn't want that. So there was that kind of embarrassment and shame. And then beyond that, it was a very difficult time, even though it was ostensibly a very lucky thing to get a school, lucky place to go to, like smaller classes and very good teachers and tennis courts and
tennis rackets,
movie nights. The movie nights at the boarding house were just some of the best times ever. You'd put in your little sweets, or you put an order in for a bag of sweets, and you could spend like £1.50, and then all the lads, all the young lads they'd all come down, and you'd bagsy a bit on the sofa or on the floor, and you'd have your duvet and
duvets,
and then you'd vote.
That is great.
You'd vote on a movie, and you know, we watched. Sometimes the housemaster would play stuff like the Marx Brothers. I got into the Marx Brothers there, and like they would be like on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And then, yeah, they played The Abyss.
Wow.
One of the best times was when all the other boys had got to go home and you didn't.
Like Harry Potter at Christmas in Hogwarts.
Like Harry Potter at Christmas, you haven't been sent home. So there's only, say, 10 boys in this massive house. And to kind of make it so it wasn't really sad for you that everyone else had gone home to see their family.
Yeah.
It would be that you got fish and chips ordered in. So you'd have fish and chips. So you'd have this lovely meal. But deep down inside, you were like, no one wants me.
You didn't like Alexander Payne's The Leftovers. I didn't realise it was ringing a real chord for you, an emotional chord.
That's why that film should have made me cry.
And it didn't.
And it didn't.
Yeah, it's too. You're still, that part of you's still buried down there. Like you had to bury it in this boarding school. Yeah.
But those movie nights were very fond memories of that. And then seeing The Abyss. And I remember my key movie memory of that is during on Her Majesty's Secret Service, at the end of that, Bond, played by George Lazenby, he's in a car and he's with Diana Rigg, who he's just married, and then the baddies shoot at his car, and she dies in the car crash. And he takes her, and he's heartbroken, and he kisses her. And I went, oh, he's kissing a dead body. And I got sent up to the room. I didn't get to see the end of the movie. Although that, I was going to say, that was the end of the movie, but I felt like I'd missed even more of the movie than I had. That was basically the end of the movie, but I felt a deep shame of that. And I think that maybe that's why I shush people in the cinema.
Maybe that is. We finally found the nub of the shusher. The shusher wasn't born. The shusher was made.
Oh, shushers. Shushers are made. And I was made.
I was born in the shush.
Anyway, that feels like a very long...
No, there's more.
Oh, from you?
Yeah, there's no more from your siblings, don't worry. I was just going to say two things about boarding school that I have heard. One, from my friend Seb, who went to Eton, but was there on a sort of in a weird capacity where, again, like he wasn't a wealthy child, but he was at Eton, you know? He said the key thing, the crucial thing is to understand these people, the very wealthy people that go there, is that only one of them is the richest person at the school. Everyone else is looking up at the people who are richer than them, and they don't feel rich. Do you know what I mean? And the other thing was, you reminded me of this when you were saying everyone wanted to kind of play it down a little bit, that they weren't that wealthy. I remember listening to a great podcast episode with Ken Clark, the old father of the house, the Conservative member of parliament. And he said something very interesting. He said that despite coming from himself, from a kind of well-to-do family in terms of their income, he said that at his schools, he was always considered riffraff on the condition that his parents bought their own furniture and didn't inherit it. And I'd never heard that before, but apparently there was a distinction between people who had bought their furniture. They were lowly. They were new money. You know, they were kind of riffraff who didn't really belong in this place with the people who'd inherited their furniture that had been, you know, passed down from generation to generation, this old aristocratic stuff. And I thought, oh, that's a good fact.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host, and Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost. The ghost.
Hi, welcome to the Movies You Forgot, You Forgot podcast. Hey, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good, man.
Yeah, well, we've done all that business about getting to know each other.
Yeah.
This is the show in which we talk about the movies this is the show where we talk about the movies we'd forgot we'd even seen in the first place, or films. I am your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever is Detective of Shame, Mr. Joe Devine. He will sniff out your shame. He'll call around the people you know, and he will say, give me some filth. I want to smash this horrible little shit's face in it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of guy he is. Here he is.
It is, man. And I like to imagine that in this scenario, that shame smells a little bit like old tuna, you know?
I'd say shame smells like dried... I don't want to say it, but yeah, dried semen.
Dried semen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Musty.
Certainly your shame smells like that.
Yeah, you know, so your shame smells of old tuna.
Yeah.
And mine smells of cum.
Yeah. No, dried cum.
Yeah, old.
That's a different smell to fresh. Pulsing cum.
Pulsing. On today's episode, we are doing the 1989 sci-fi flick, The Abyss, directed by James Cameron, stars Ed Harris and Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Oh, yeah, no, and also Michael Biehn.
Yeah.
Michael Biehn. And here is the letterboxed. When you get there, you will understand. A civilian oil rig is recruited to conduct a search and rescue effort when a nuclear submarine mysteriously sinks. One diver soon finds himself in a spectacular odyssey 25,000 feet below the ocean's surface, where he confronts a mysterious force that has the power to change the world or destroy it.
Oh.
That last sentence is the entirety of the third act.
That's also the first of many references to 2001 A Space Odyssey, I think.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to Space Odyssey because I've got James Cameron on 2001 Space Odyssey.
Obsessed.
What's your IMDb?
Well, the IMDb said, not dissimilar, a civilian diving team is enlisted to search for a lost nuclear submarine and faces danger while encountering an alien aquatic species.
Well, let's get straight back into 2001.
Yeah.
So I got the DVD of this. You can't stream The Abyss anymore, although it did pop up on ITVX.
That's how I watched it. ITV being a region, a national channel here in the UK.
It won't be there forever.
No.
It's not something that you can pay to rent on Apple TV or Amazon, whatever. Do you want to know why you can't get it on... Well, I don't know if this is the reason. You can't get... It's not available on Blu-ray and hasn't been updated in the UK. Do you want to know why?
Why?
Because of the scene with the rat.
Oh, yeah. Do you know what? That was... That is cut from the ITVX version.
Is there anything to do with the rat in that you saw? Because I got the DVD.
Yeah, so I basically they crop the bit where they put the rat underwater, and you maybe can tell the listeners what actually happened in that situation. I read about it afterwards too, but I was provoked to read about it because it kept coming up in my reading, and I thought, but hang on, I didn't see that on screen. I went back to check, and they've cropped it in the TV version, so it's obviously been removed presumably for animal rights reasons.
There's some Navy SEALs who go down to this oil rig, and before they go off on the diving mission, this Navy SEAL is showing one of the oil rig divers this special pink fluid that they've invented, this liquid that you have in a diving outfit, and then it fills up, and then if you breathe in the fluid, you can then breathe underwater.
Well, it's in order to balance the pressure, because as you go deeper in the ocean, obviously there's more pressure on you from the water around, and the thinking being that if you were also suspended within liquid, that pressure would be lessened and you could go deeper.
So anyway, the Navy SEAL showcases the pink fluid and how it works by dunking someone's pet rat in the pink fluid.
Yes.
And on the DVD, it's really weird. You don't see it, but you see them all looking at the rat that's obviously drowning or not. And it's very...
Same.
Yeah. So anyway, that's always been a cause of consternation to the BBFC in the UK, and so
fair enough.
Horrible,
because it's real. You know this, right? Like, it's not that so the truth is that the liquid does exist. It's not an invention of James Cameron. It's never been tested on humans, but it has been tested on rats. So what you're seeing in the film is the rat actually being forced to breathe in the oxygenated liquid.
What?
Which is obviously horrible. It's not that they're forcing the rat to hold its breath underwater or risking the death of the rat. They're forcing it to happen as a display on the screen. At least this is what I read afterwards. And that sounds very James Cameron-y, you know. But the liquid does literally exist.
That guy hates rats.
He hates rats. I mean, he wants rats to breathe exclusively liquid oxygen. Let me just double check this, because now that you don't know that, I'm afraid that isn't true, but I'm pretty certain that's the case. Okay, so I'm reading from an article on filmschoolrejects.com, The Abyss Breathing Fluid. Under the subheading, How Did They Do That?, which is asking about the rat and the breathing. So what's going on here? In The Abyss, we see what looks like a rat breathing in fluid and living to tell the tale. And here's leading man Ed Harris, later on appearing to do the same for a good chunk of the movie's third act. So what's Cameron up to exactly? The rat demonstration scene in The Abyss was unsimulated and used real-life oxygenated breathing fluids. Ed Harris, however, was tasked with pretending to breathe underwater in his water-filled helmet, which was especially challenging during the underwater shots, of which there were many. They really did it. And I can totally understand why animal rights groups or people would find that unpleasant. I wouldn't have wanted to see that, knowing that was the case. And I think it wouldn't pass muster in most film sets today, right?
No, I wouldn't have liked to have seen it. I think now's the time I'm going to slot in Ed Harris on him. Like, never mind the rat. Ed Harris thought he was going to die when he was in that suit. It's the best bit of the documentary, you know, the that's on. I think you can probably get it on YouTube as well. It's like The Making of the Abyss. At the time, it was the toughest shoot in film history. They used an existing nuclear bunker, and they filled it with 7.5 million gallons of water. These are the notes I took. And they built the rig, the underwater rig that you see, you know, that Cameron wanted to film it like for like, reel for reel, underwater movie. And it's a staggering achievement. But anyway, Ed Harris underwater during one of these shoots, he thought he was going to die. So the clip I'm going to play is Harris reflecting on one of these dive shoots.
Yeah, I mean, to tee this up as well, what happens is that Ed Harris is filming underwater in a suit that's also filled with water. And so whenever he needs to go and breathe, he has to make his way over to a member of the crew who comes down and gives him a breathing tube to breathe from. Anyway, there's one moment where he's running out of air and he goes over to get some air, but the crew member's not there. And by the time the crew member comes down, a series of things go wrong. The mouth tube gets put in the wrong way. He takes in a big breath. It's half water, half air. He's spluttering and coughing. Eventually, he's sort of rescued by someone else in the crew. And this is at a point in the shoot where there are many more scenes, many more days where he's going to have to go back and do this thing again. A really horrible experience where he thought for a moment that he was going to die.
This is his reflection on nearly dying underwater.
But I remember driving home that night, and I just broke down, man. I was just weeping because there was a part of me that was really disappointed in myself for not being able to do this thing. And there was also a part of me that was like, I just didn't know what to do. I was just, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I was in the middle of something that I just, and it was, and I really thought I was going to die for a second, and it also pissed me off that I was afraid of that, that I got scared of that for a second. It was a all total mixture of so many things, you know. And though it never got that dangerous again, I always had to be in that suit until the last day of shooting. I would, not every day, but there was always, I always knew I was going to have to go back down in this fucking fluid breathing suit.
Yeah, I'm okay.
So you tell me when you're getting uncomfortable.
Okay. All right. Get the shot over.
Ed is probably the ultimate trooper in the world. And if he wasn't before the abyss, he certainly is afterwards. You know, it was a big, big challenge. And just Ed just did it day after day. He just stepped up to the plate and did it. You know, it was really something to watch.
That's horrible, man.
That the way he says, I was so disappointed in myself. Absolutely, just like, I just thought, fucking hell. I don't know. That was just this amazing insight of just like, he's angry with himself because he couldn't do the thing, but it's like he almost died. And him, this is Ed Harris. He's struggling. He's one of the most amazing actors of all time. Yeah. What I'm watching this was him made it the very long film very, very watchable. And then this is him just telling a story and watching his face emote. It is just, it was the best thing about the whole The Abyss experience. But yeah, like, how'd you like them apples, eh?
I didn't like those apples very much at all. And to be honest, one of my main experiences watching this was I was frequently distraught at the notion of what the actors would have had to have gone through and the crew in order to film it. I was aware that this was, you know, classically complex technical challenge from a filmmaking perspective, and I know James Cameron's, you know, one of the only people to have gone as deep as he's gone in the ocean in his weird little boat, right? Like, I'm aware of his specific niche interest in this area. I kept thinking, do you know, sometimes you watch a film and think, oh, I would have liked to have played that character, or I would have liked to have been Jason Bourne or whatever. I didn't want to be anyone in this film. I didn't like it.
Why'd you fucking bring it up as a film?
I don't know. I forgot how much drowning there was in it. if you'll allow me, it feels like the appropriate time to bring this up. Because I was aware, as I said, that this was a challenging shoot. So I asked ChatGPT if it could give me some examples of other films where there was an extreme environmental challenge or a technical challenge or a scale and complexity challenge to the filmmaking.
I bet they said The Revenant.
But there were a number of films that came up here. The Revenant's one of them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was going to ask you if you've got very excited. I think what's happened there is you've thought maybe it's a game. You're worried I'm going to tell you, so you've just shouted one just in case.
Sorry, I wasn't
going to tell you. I was going to ask you if you can name some, because it's thrown up some of the classic films that are mentioned during the conversation of that one was hard to film. So The Revenant is on here, 2015. Of course, we've talked about it on this podcast before. Filmed in freezing conditions with natural light. Actors, especially Leonardo DiCaprio, endured real hypothermia risks. And crew members quit due to the brutal working environment. That sounds like everyone's job I know. Anyway, can you guess any of the other films that appear on this list?
Lawrence of Arabia.
So Lawrence of Arabia hasn't come up, but I am aware that it was a challenging shoot, wasn't it?
I mean, I'm not. I'm just guessing. I'm just going to guess Sandy Places and Cold Places.
Well, Sandy Places, you're onto something. Not Sandy in Arabia. Sandy in Australia. But technically in Namibia.
Yeah, Fury Road.
Fury Road, yes, because it was shot in the Namibian desert.
Mm.
And it was months of grueling stunts and dust storms and practical effects in extreme heat. That was difficult.
Star Wars, A New Hope?
So Star Wars, A New Hope is not on the list, but something not dissimilar for sheer scale and complexity, of course, Adam, the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Mm.
Not because it was, as difficult as...
A real slog.
It was just a slog. They just had to... There was a lot going on there, wasn't there? It was very ambitious.
Andy Serkis hanging around, bringing everyone down with his rubbish voice. Andy's on set again doing his shit voice. Yeah, I know. God, this shit would be a breeze if it wasn't for Andy Serkis with his fucking ping pong balls on him. Oh, Andy's back. Can we fire this cunt? No, Andy's back. He's really important.
Do you know that actually that voice, the Gollum voice, took such a toll on Andy's throat that he had made a special concoction of like a honey lemon thick liquidy drink that he had to guzzle in the mornings in order to be able to say anything, because he was just ripping apart his throat every day doing this voice.
Yeah, all for naught.
Right. Okay. Well, no. So the other films you've said aren't on the list. There are a few. I mean, there are ones that as soon as I start to say them, you'll go, oh, obvious, of course, of course. There's one on this list that comes up every time. It was a film made by Werner Herzog, and it's a very famous story.
Aguirre, Wrath of God.
Fitzcarraldo.
Oh, Fitzcarraldo. Oh,
well,
okay.
When Werner Herzog insisted on pulling a real 320-ton steamship over a hill in the Amazon jungle without special effects.
Right, yes, of course.
It was difficult, I've heard. I think there were a lot of fallouts on that set as well.
Apocalypse Now?
Apocalypse Now is listed here, shot in the Philippines during a typhoon. The production was plagued by illness, heat, and warlike conditions. Martin Sheen had a real heart attack on set, and Marlon Brando was completely unprepared, it says.
Yeah?
I'm not sure if he's completely unprepared for Martin Sheen's heart attack or just for the film generally. But that would be a technical difficulty, wouldn't it, if your main actor just wasn't prepared?
Yeah, it would be. It would be. It was.
Well, apart from that, another James Cameron entree. I mean, there's actually two or three, technically. Titanic. James Cameron built a massive water tank. He loves building big water tanks, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it gives him the horn?
I wonder if it does. Maybe it's the only way he can get himself off.
Yeah. He can't just... The sea's like, no, not the sea. It needs to be massive, but I need to have built it and it needs to contain me. And that's the only way I can ejaculate.
Yeah. I expect that.
Allegedly. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it goes on to say actors had to endure hours in cold water and many crew members got sick or injured. All of them also hated seeing James Cameron constantly masturbating in the middle of the massive water tank. So if ChatGPT says it, it must be true. Not as though I've just inserted that.
Mm? Yeah.
Avatar and Avatar The Way of the Water also appear here as well. Because Cameron developed new motion capture technology for underwater scenes. He's always going back to the water, almost as though he is a fish.
Almost as if he's sexually driven. to be in the water. You see, here's the quick, like, can I derail the game to leave the game?
Yeah, of course.
Because I think we've done it. It comes back to Cameron.
Uh-huh.
As overlong as the abyss is, it's got the like for like, like real sets that he's created went to ludicrous extremes to do. They filled this massive nuclear bunker. I'm sure they said it was a bunker, but it's above ground. And they had to fill it with these tiny little black balls so that the surface of the water would block out the sun, so then there were no reflections. And so there are these big gloopy mass on the ceiling. He's gone to all these efforts, and then he's got these amazing actors in, and for whatever its storytelling failures are, it feels immediate and 80s, and there's lots of fun stuff in it. He gets phenomenal performances out of Ed Harris, Michael Biehn, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Now my question is, how does this same director, who knows he can get this this kind of texture and amazing performances, how does this man then go on to want to make something like Avatar, which is phony and looks fake and has got no weight to it whatsoever? You know, like Kate Winslet, when she's in the second one of Avatar, she learned how to hold her breath underwater for 15 minutes. Now you're watching her as a cartoon, and you've got no semblance that she actually did that. It doesn't make any sense. Do you know what
I
mean?
It's like method directing.
It's like, yeah, he's decided he wants to do it as it's got to make, if it's the harder it is. This is his quote actually about 2001, A Space Odyssey. I mentioned that at the beginning, and then we got waylaid. I waylaid us. He says at the beginning of the doc, he wanted to do for underwater movies what 2001 did for space. And if he couldn't do that, why bother? Like, he's all about hubris. He's Harry Hubris.
He's Harry Hubris.
Yeah, he's got the hubris. He's like, oh, I'm not just going to make a film unless it can be epic. And unless we reinvent how we do all this, forget it. You know?
I do know. I mean, I think that's in some ways to be admired. There's something to be said for someone who desires to push the craft forwards in a particular direction, and maybe make space for people behind them to use those, take the use of those opportunities, but maybe do something a little different with it. I mean, I've always felt with James Cameron that the film is the afterthought to the possibility of whether the film can be filmed or not. Do you know what I mean? And in some senses, that means he's a kind of pioneer. But in the same way that, like, Captain Scott got to the South Pole first, but boy, did he fuck it up on the way. You know, other people learned from that, and then when they got to the South Pole, they sort of did it in a much safer way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to capture something. He's trying to capture images that haven't been captured before. And he does do that, like the nuts and bolts of how, like, you would have, how boring and long it would have taken just to film all the little pieces, the little shots of that make up the abyss.
Yeah.
And to just see that out and have that commitment to see, like, I think that it was, they were on that set for about a year. I'm pulling that figure out of my ass. It was a long time. They had actors just underwater twiddling their thumbs for hours, you know, waiting for the right conditions to shoot, and like, you've got to have like such self-belief in the idea, and like, you're just filming, say, 5 seconds of Ed Harris in his underwater suit, like, do a little bit of swimming, and then it's cut, and then it's reset, and it's like, that would have been, that's hours worth of effort just to get like a tiny little snippet. It's insane.
Yeah, it is insane. But also, it's, you know, it's part of, it's a contribution to...
Well, he's the only one who's done it.
He's the only person who's done it. And this is one contribution to the overall creative process that James Cameron has used to twice break the, you know, global cinema box office record with massive films that, whether you liked them or not, everyone in the world went to go and see. And I think you kind of have to give it to him a little bit. You know, it's like he has transformed what cinema is, and he is a bit like one of those mental, like, tech billionaires that, you know, is a visionary, but also maybe a dick. I'm not saying that James Cameron is maybe a dick. I'm just saying, in the same way that, you know, you have kind of the light and the dark, like, maybe this is it, right? You know, maybe with James Cameron, it's just the case that he has a very specific, incredible vision when it comes to technical filmmaking and the realization of something complicated and previously undone that he desires to make real. And to him, maybe, you know, I've heard him say that's, you know, this is all in the service of story. I don't understand how that's the case from watching his films.
Yeah, I think they are in service to story. His stories are very, very basic. He just tends to, he's self-indulgent. But then when you've gone to the lengths that he's gone to, maybe that's baked into being into his whole thing. Like, if he's done all that work to shoot The Abyss, maybe he wants his whole extra hour-long third act where Ed Harris just falls into Abyss and then meets aliens, and it's really boring. It's like he wants to really hammer the point home that, you know what, these are actually not bad aliens. Did you not think it was pretty cool how no one ever says the word aliens in this film?
Sure, yeah. They what do they say? They say, like,
NTIs.
NTIs, yeah.
And it's like, this is James Cameron thinking, I've just made the film Aliens. I'm not going to have anyone say the word aliens in a film that's got aliens in. And it's like, mate, come on, they're oil rig workers. All they're going to be saying, they're going to be making ET jokes, and they're going to be saying aliens, aliens, aliens. No one says aliens. There's another fantastic detail in this film. Did you spot Ed Harris at the start of the movie? He throws his wedding ring into a toilet full of blue bleach.
I did notice this, yeah.
He swiftly comes back in, puts his hand in the toilet bowl to retrieve his wedding ring. It's a lovely little scene because it tells you everything through action, how Ed Harris feels about his estranged wife. He still loves her, but boy, is he frustrated at her. Now, his hand is covered in this horrible blue bleach. His hand, Ed Harris's hand, is blue for the whole movie. I think you're laughing, right? I think that's amazing. It's like any other movie now would have gone, his hand doesn't have to be blue now
because
he's washed it off. It's just bleach that washes off. And Cameron's like, no, that's industrial bleach that's going to have made his hand blue. And Ed Harris's hand is blue. Throughout the entire, for the rest of the movie, and I just kept thinking.
And that's where he got the idea for Avatar from.
I knew you couldn't resist it. I do not think that level of detail and the attention and thought that's gone into that. If you have a hat, take it off.
I agree. My hat is off. But then the hat just is also on the whole time, because I think it's a fantastic level of detail. I'm delighted that he's done that, that you've noticed that. I'm delighted that, you know, I see things being done for the first time ever, and that there's a great achievement at hand here. And well done to everyone involved. I really mean that.
Did you mean that pun?
No, what did I say?
You said at hand. You said at hand. At hand.
There's a great blue achievement at hand here. I really do mean well done to everyone involved, because clearly you'd have to really want to do the things that they did in order to achieve them. The problem is the movie sucks. Like, you know,
sucks.
Yeah, it does. Ultimately, it does. Like, my conclusion is that it's not good enough for me to broadly enjoy elements of it. If halfway through the film, which, by the way, in my head, I'm like, this is the end of the film. We mentioned it already. There's a scene where the pod is sinking and the two main characters have to swim back, and one of them gonna intentionally drown, and there's a dramatic resuscitation. And this is after they've just killed the main antagonist, yeah? They've overcome the thing that has happened. Now, they're going to reconcile, and that was also the little subplot, the estranged man and wife. Now they're reconciled, and the film's going to end, right? It's going to end, right? Oh, no, there's over an hour left of this film, where the stakes are what? There's maybe an armed bomb somewhere, Who cares? There's some alien stuff.
It's going to blow up aliens that they've never met before.
If the film ended there, I would think this is a lovely little late 80s film with some great ideas, with a really cool sort of almost like a sleight of hand, a red herring, a kind of, there's a bit of an alien thing there, isn't there? But you never explore, you never really understand what that's about. That's very exciting to me. That would be a truer reflection, a fairer, a more appropriate celebration of 2001 A Space Odyssey, of James Cameron's love for that film, you know. But instead, what happens is that, as you say, we then have to watch Ed Harris in a big liquid suit falling for ages, going deeper and deeper, typing back on the old computer like in 2001 A Space Odyssey, looking through his glass helmet with all the lights as they appear, like in 2001 A Space Odyssey, meeting with some sort of aliens that, you know, you can't really hear and that stay ethereal and above us and better than us, and, you know, it's all monolithic and they're all NTIs and whatever, and just like in 2001 A Space Odyssey, and then with all the same themes of the film as well. And then at the end, come up to the top of the water with the, 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I don't know if you noticed this bit I hated the most, because all of the things you described before, the beautiful attention to detail, the all the admirable lengths that they went to, I feel like they might as well have all stopped at that hour before the end of the film arc, where the actual first film ends. Because when the second film starts, it's a bit like From Dusk Till Dawn, isn't it? It's like Robert Rodriguez has come in and filmed and directed the second half of it. Because all of a sudden, that attention to detail goes out the window. They all get up to the top of the water immediately after a film which is based around pressurizing and repressurizing and fears about the bends and psychological symptoms coming from this distress being put on the body. And then one of the characters says, as though to avert the sharp intentions of the audience, who will go, "Hang on a sec, didn't they just surface immediately, even though it took them hours to get down there?" One of the characters says, doesn't he, "We just got up here immediately and we're fine. The aliens must have done something." And I thought, yes, how convenient for you, James Cameron. The aliens have done something. You know, what a fucking waste of a second half of a film. It actually makes me annoyed, because the first half could be so great. And the first half is Alien. Yeah. The second half is 2001 A Space Odyssey. And one of those things is replicable and the other one isn't. And James Cameron's fucked it.
Yeah, that's one of the worst lines of movie dialogue I think I've heard.
It's bad.
I think the aliens must have done something.
Yeah.
I mean, that's worse than Eagles.
Sure.
And I like this film a lot more than Return of the King.
Don't say that.
One of my favourite lines...
I don't even
lines...
like that. That's not even a funny joke.
Wait! Take a step.
Should we play the box office game?
Yeah, I'd love to play the box office game. Let's do it. I'm curious how you're going to do with this film, because it was obviously quite expensive. But how expensive is expensive? That's the real question.
Yeah, for 89, that is the question.
It's quite a challenging one, I would say. So let's start as usual with budget, brackets estimated, for the film The Abyss.
They built so much... They built the vat of water. They built this underwater rig. They built models. There's amazing model work in this. And how much is that back in old money in 89?
Well, I'm going to get an inflation calculator for us so that I can tell you what it was in 89 and then what it would be if the film was being made in 2024.
Did it cost $40 million?
It didn't. It cost quite a lot more than that, Adam.
Okay.
In 1989, I guess they would have been making it in 1988. The film cost an estimated $70 million to make.
Okay, yeah, that makes... Right, what's that now?
Which in today's money is, after inflation, is $177 million.
Oof.
So it's expensive.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Big time. Big time. So I guess this now means, what do we think it took? Opening weekend, US and Canada, August 13th, 1989. How much is this taking? Given that it has aliens and the Terminator, you know, the guy who brought you these on the poster, you would have thought it would be popular.
I don't know. It's because I saw the trailer and it doesn't sell itself.
No, it's weird. The trailer's weird, isn't it?
I don't think it made a lot of money. It's like wanky sci-fi, and I don't think people are going to go and see it. There's no explosions or anything. People don't necessarily care. Like, oh, you went to all this effort to make a film.
Yeah, the nuke never goes off.
Oh, the gun's always supposed to go off, isn't it? Chekhov's bomb. $8 million?
Very close. It made $9.3 million.
Nice, I'll take that.
Yeah, I think you should take that. It's not far off, not far off at all. Now, of course, the final here, gross worldwide. Of course, you've got the 10x rule if you want to apply it.
Well, I don't think people would have liked it. I know we didn't like it.
I thought we didn't like it.
I did like it. I liked it fine. You didn't like it.
I liked it fine up until 90 minutes in, and then I stopped liking it.
I can imagine late 80s audiences finding it quite challenging. Oh, do you know what I'm going to do for gross worldwide? It always works well when I guess my budget.
Uh-huh.
So I guessed 40 for the budget. I'm going to guess 40 for the gross worldwide.
Right. But you know the film cost more. The film cost 70.
Yeah, I don't think it made its money back. I don't think it was well received. It only made 8.
It made 9. You guessed 8.
Right, okay, but you know, that's not jumper territory.
It certainly isn't. But it was 1989, so I think this actually would have been more like 18 million today.
Oh, that's close.
Oh, actually, no, it would have been much
territory.
More. It would have been 20 million today.
Oh, that's close to jumper territory, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it was.
In fact, it would have
territory.
Been more than that, because 100 times 150% is roughly the inflation from then to
just
there.
Pick?
So I would say it's actually going to be about $23 million opening weekend if that was released today.
Yeah, but that's against a budget of 170. You just, why bother dialing it up?
Of course.
You're dialing up both numbers. It's pointless.
No, I understand. I'm just saying, you know, you're comparing it to jumper, and you're not doing any dialing at all, and you'll never get on the phone that way.
Yeah, but I just say things. It doesn't matter.
That is true.
So I'm saying 40 because I said 40 for the budget. It's just that's how I play the game.
Yeah, it's just that you're quite far off, so I thought you know, I was just trying to steer you.
Oh, okay, fine. It made 120.
You're not further off, but you've almost skipped it entirely. It made $90 million,
okay.
This film, $90 million. So I don't know how much they would have spent on advertising back in the day, marketing.
But the same. Okay.
The same.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's
even
not
more.
Washing its face. Not more.
Not
they're
more.
Not spending more.
No. Okay.
But they're
but
not,
it's
washing,
not washing
its
face.
No, it's not. For a water-based movie, that's criminal.
For a water-based movie, it's criminal, Cameron.
Shall we do the bit of the show where one of us reads out a list of movies they forgot?
Yeah.
I'm gonna hold my hands up. I went, after our listener email episode, I went back to read the emails so I could reply to them. And I saw in some of the emails, there were some suggestions. But they're so good that they're on my list now.
No, you can't steal them from the communal list.
They're not on the communal list. They're just in emails.
They were en route to the communal list.
No, they've been intercepted.
This seems all very not unfair, you know. Not unfair.
Why?
This all seems unfair.
Why?
Well, because those were bound for the communal list and you've intercepted them.
No, but...
You can't be trusted with the emails.
No, but I would have thought of these... And then also, I think it gives people extra incentive. Sometimes I might think, yeah, that's a good one. I'm having that.
I think you've broken the sacred bond with the audience.
So here we go.
Yeah.
End of Days.
End of Days. What's that?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, Gabriel Byrne.
Let me just Google it because...
This was a Siavesh.
No, I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's rubbish. Okay. Super 8.
I never watched Super 8.
That was John Powell's suggestion. Don't blame me. That's John Powell.
Well, ironically, what's interesting here is that you're using communal list suggestions, but this might be the first time we get to the audience might be the people that drag you over the
reason.
Edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it will still be your fault.
Well, I've still got ones that I know for a fact you've forgotten.
Okay.
So
we'll see.
Bad Santa.
I've never seen it.
Daniel Daltrey, you suck as well, mate. Okay, fine. You mentioned it, so I'm going to say it. From Dusk Till Dawn.
Well, I mean, I hadn't forgotten it because I just said, talked about it in this podcast. Said it. You know, I just said it.
Yeah, but you were, well, yeah, but you've can you remember anything from that movie?
Yes.
What?
It's directed by two different people. I've watched it twice. The first time was probably 15 years ago. The second time was in the last 4 years, I would say. It goes mental halfway through. The second half is directed by Robert Rodriguez. The first half is directed by Quentin Tarantino. It's got George Clooney in it all the way through. And, you know, it's fine.
I think the level of shrift you've given that is a little bit, you've over-egged the shrift because it would have been a fun one to do.
It might have been.
You don't have to be a twat about it.
I wasn't trying to be a twat about it. I was actually a little bit offended that you
succeed.
I've never pressed you when you've, this is a game of honor. Okay. It's a game of honor. And I gave you my honorable response, which was to say I hadn't forgotten that film. And you pushed me on it. You pushed me on it, didn't you? And you're upset that you got a little bit of a shrift back. I'm like, sorry, where did the honour code go? I thought we were friends. And now what you hear suggesting that I'm lying about it.
Well, I'm pretty sure that on the, you know, months ago, that was mooted. And I've got a memory of you sort of saying, yeah, oh, that's very forgettable.
Well, I don't feel that way today, if I ever did. And there's only one person here that looks a fool, and it's you. Plus, you're on your last one, Adam. Like, this is serious. Otherwise, we are actually going to the communal list, even though
we're... It's not serious, because I know for a fact I'm playing one that I know you've said is a forget you forgot.
Okay, let's hear it.
Minority Report.
It's almost unfair to play the Cruise card, you know. Have we not done too much Cruise?
This is Spielberg, okay? Cruise, we don't even have to talk about Cruise when it comes to Minority Report. We won't even mention his name. That'll be really fun. The fun game of that episode will be if we don't even mention Tom Cruise. Might be hard.
We can try. We can reference his character name.
I've just written down Minority Cruise. That's Minority Cruise. But so we're going to do Minority Report. You know, are you not excited?
I am.
You're just worried about the Cruise.
No, I am excited because it's been a long time since I've seen the film Minority Report. And I can't wait to get a report on those minorities. I want to know what they've been up to, what they've been doing. I want to see what I've missed. Well, I've only been paying attention to the majority. And I'm looking forward to catching up. It's going to be like old times, you know?
Great. So this has been The Abyss. Apologies to James Cameron. I've said a lot of erms there.
I'm going to cut those out. Don't you worry about it.
Please do cut my erms.